So this is our third class. We're doing a little series on the Pali Canon, and we kind of talked about we introduced the Pali Canon a little bit. We've talked about two suttas, right? You did the Kalama and what was the other one?
That other one.
Yes, there's lots of them. And tonight I want to talk about one that's quite famous. But before I start, I need your help to help identify who wrote those famous poetic lines. Come on, baby, light my fire.
Jim Morrison.
Okay. I thought so, and then I wasn't sure.
Oh,
you heard? Yeah. Yeah. Like some kind of test.
Yeah. Right. And the reason I ask that, because we have a certain image or an understanding of fire in a kind of emotional or poetic way. But we're certainly not the first group of people who take up fire as a special symbol. And tonight I want to introduce what's called the Fire Sermon Discourse. At least that's in one translation. And this is one of the most well-known and pivotal suttas that the Buddha taught. So it's kind of important for us to at least have some idea about it, I think. And I brought some copies so we can look at it together. But before that, I'd like to introduce the background to it, because it's very interesting, I think. Many of the suttas have background stories, and sometimes they're right in the sutta itself. They'll give you a little background, you know, it was taught by the Buddha at such and such a place, when so-and-so asked this particular question, and there it goes. And sometimes the background is not in the sutta, but in a commentary. And this is the background written in a commentary. So the Fire Sermon Discourse is one of the earliest that the Buddha gave, as far as we know. At least that's what's claimed in the Pali tradition. His first teaching, his first kind of real recorded teaching, was known as the Deer Park Sutta, and that's when he went and kind of expounded the kind of bare bones of his teaching to a group of ascetics who used to be his friends and partners, and then they left him when he decided he would take in nourishment rather than continue with the extreme fasting and ascetic practices that were being done by many seekers in those days. After that, he left and began wandering. And this was a very common practice in India at the time, and still is today, where spiritual seekers and practitioners will often wander from place to place, begging for food and then offering teachings freely, but often they would get food or shelter. So he was wandering, and he came upon a group of fire-worshipping ascetics. And fire worship is very common in many different religious traditions, and is very common in India at the time. And it still is. Fire is very important within the Hindu tradition. Many homes of people who belong in that tradition will have a small fire, like a candle or a lamp burning. And the flame is considered sacred and symbolic of the divine, particularly a divine figure called Agni. But at the time of the Buddha, I'm not exactly sure what significance fire worship had, but many people followed this idea of worshiping fire. And again, I think the fire was a kind of symbolic representation of some divine force. And remember, this was the Iron Age. And I think we all worship fire at some point, don't we? I mean, around a campfire, you're staring into the fire, or if you have a fireplace or a wood stove, as we do, it's wonderful to watch the flames. They do have a very powerful, almost charismatic quality to them. So after wandering, he came upon this group of fire-worshipping ascetics. And according to the commentary, this was a group of about 1,000 guys. And as was traditional at that time, these ascetics did not wear clothes, and they never cut their hair or washed their hair. So it was, you know, thick and what you can imagine. And these were 1,000 guys kind of living together, doing these special ceremonies around fires. And they would kind of tend the fire, keep it going constantly. And there was this was all done under the leadership of Uddhavala Kashyapa. And Uddhavala Kashyapa welcomed the Buddha as a kind of a fellow seeker and said, well, you know, you're welcome to stay, but we're kind of crowded here, as you can see. There's only one place that's available that you could spend the night in, and that's in the bathhouse. Now, don't ask me why they had a bathhouse, but apparently they did, rather than just going to the river. This is according to the commentary. And it's very common to offer lodgings to these wandering ascetics at the time. Uddhavala Kashyapa said, you know, actually, I need to warn you about the bathhouse, though. There's a naga that lives in the bathhouse, a naga. And a naga is a kind of dragon or cobra-like being, often very powerful and can be quite dangerous. And for some reason, they like to hang out in bathhouses. There's other stories where they appear in bathhouses. And the Buddha said, "Oh, that's okay. That's okay. I'm not afraid. I'll make do somehow." And so he goes off and he spends the night in this bathhouse with the naga. And during the night, Uddhavala Kashyapa, probably tending the fires, or wakes up, and he sees smoke and fire pouring out of the bathhouse, and he thinks, "Oh." Oh, that poor wandering ascetic is toast. And he tends his fire and maybe spends the night being quite concerned. However, the next morning, the Buddha appears with his begging bowl, as was the custom. You would leave early in the morning, go begging for food. And he walks up to Uddhavala Kashyapa, and in his bowl is a little coiled sleeping snake. And the story goes on. There's kind of a little bit of dialogue and story that goes on, which I won't go into tonight, between Uddhavala Kashyapa and the Buddha. But eventually, Uddhavala Kashyapa says, I realize I thought I was awakened, but I realize I'm not, and I can see that you are, and I would like to become your disciple. And the Buddha says, fine, you're welcome. And because the leader of this group of fire-worshipping ascetics has become Buddha's disciple, they all become Buddha's disciple. Very Japanese in that way, even though this is happening in India, right? So they all decide they're going to follow the Buddha, and they become monks. And so they make good use of the bathhouse. They get cleaned up and they shave their heads. So they're nice and clean, which was the style of the Buddha at that time. And the Buddha, then after they have, he's ordained all of these 1,000 monks, he then gives this famous fire sermon. And I think it's really represents his characteristically really brilliant teaching style, because the Buddha uses the metaphor that often quickly penetrates the heart and minds of the audience. And in this case, he uses the metaphor of fire, because of course they have spent, you know, these years tending the sacred fires and have lots of lore and stories around the sacred fire. So, and again, according to the commentaries, and I think also it's in the sutta. Is it in the sutta? Just have a quick peek. Yes. Upon hearing the sutta expounded by the Buddha, they are all full of joy and they all are awakened. So maybe we'll be lucky tonight as we look at this piece of sutta. Now, you may have come across this term, the first sermon, before. If you have read, maybe in high school or other places, The Wasteland by T.S. Eliot, there's a section or a chapter, if you call it a chapter section, called The Fire Sermon in there. And it comes from, he read this, T.S. Eliot read this sutta, and he was so impressed with it that he kind of wove at least some of the ideas of that into his famous poem. So let me pass these out. And what I'd like to do, we're not going to read the whole thing, because it's just so we have a little bit, some time to talk, but I'd like to, we'll be reading some first parts of it. Sorry, can I see yours for a moment? I just want to make sure. Yeah. Pardon? Oh, okay. So we'll have enough, or almost enough. Two people may have to be bodhisattvas and share. Well, we got lots. Okay. Good. Can you pass one more back down this way for Kate?
Different page.
Oh, that's something else. Yeah, sorry. Sorry, that's something else. Oh, I thought I had a lot. No, I had some stuff left over in my bag. So you guys, you don't have one. So we're gonna have some sharing to do.
It's a two
pages. Yes.
You share it, and we'll share it.
Okay.
We're okay.
We're okay?
We're okay. Thank you. Sorry about that. So we're going to read the first several paragraphs. Could someone maybe start us off by just reading the first little paragraph there? Hi, Doug.
I have heard that on one occasion, the Blessed One was staying in Gaya, at Gaya Head, with 1,000 monks. There he addressed the monks.
So this is a very common opening you'll see in many of the suttas. It kind of often starts, thus I have heard, or I have heard, and this is, of course, Ananda reciting the story that he has heard, and then it's recorded. Okay, so someone the next line, please. Next paragraph.
Monks, the all is a flame. What all is a flame? The eye is a flame. Forms are a flame. Consciousness at the eye is a flame. Contact at the eye is a flame. And whatever there is that arises in dependence on contact at the eye, experienced as pleasure, pain, or neither pleasure nor pain, that too is a flame. A flame with what? A flame with the fire of passion, the fire of aversion, the fire of delusion. A flame, I tell you, with birth, aging, and death, with sorrows, lamentations, pains, distresses, and despairs.
Thank you. That's cheery. And could someone read the next one, please? We'll just read the first, I think, three, and then I'll make some comments. Okay, go ahead.
The ear is a flame. Sounds are a flame. Consciousness at the ear is a flame. Contact at the ear is a flame. And whatever there is that arises in dependence on contact at the ear, experience as pleasure, pain, or neither pleasure nor pain, that too is a flame. A flame with what? A flame with the fire of passion, the fire of aversion, the fire of delusion. A flame, I tell you, with birth, aging, and death, with sorrows, lamentations, pains, distresses, and despairs.
Again, thank you. And one more.
Good. Sure. The nose is a flame. Aromas are a flame. Consciousness at the nose is a flame. Contact at the nose is a flame. And whatever there is that arises in dependence on contact at the nose, experienced as pleasure, pain, or neither pleasure nor pain, that too is a flame. A flame of what? A flame of the fire of passion, the fire of aversion, the fire of delusion. A flame, I tell you, with birth and aging and death, with sorrows, lamentations, pains, distresses, and despairs.
Good, thank you. Well, you can see it follows a pattern that is easy to memorize. It kind of repeats itself, and this is because it was an oral tradition for hundreds of years before anything was ever written down. And you'll find this very common in many of the suttas, this kind of repetition. You also have noticed, of course, that it's starting to go through all our senses, the five senses, right? That this is a flame, you know, tongue, taste, touch, sound. The five that we normally recognize in our psychology, but they also have an additional one, and that's the, I think here he translates it as the intellect, or sometimes it's translated as the mind. And the objects are a flame, so as well as the sense itself, as well as the consciousness that is connected to the sense. This is just how during the Buddhist time, they saw human psychology and how it interacts with the world working. There are separate consciousnesses connected to each sense. And the mind sense, the object for the mind senses are thoughts. So they treat the mind as a kind of sense, and we sense our thoughts. Even though we have no control over them, but they appear, right? They appear like tastes on the tongue or sounds in the ear. For us, that's not too much of a concern, but just wanted to kind of point that out, this kind of going through everything and this idea of pointing out that everything we perceive, everything we think is a flame. And a flame with what? Here, Thanissaro Bhikkhu, the person who translates this, says delusions, aversion, and passion. And these are the three poisons that are translated in many different ways. You know, greed, hatred, ignorance. There's many other words that people use, but these represent the three poisons. I think, although this seems kind of strong when we first read it, I think that the Buddha here is really directly pointing to our experience or looking at our dis-ease with our own life. Just in the sense, as a physician, we kind of look closely to make sure that he or she has the right diagnosis. This is the disease, right? This is what it is, you know, understanding it. That the Buddha says it's really important that we understand what is the cause of our dis-ease with our life. And what he points out, of course, is that it is the three poisons. It is our clinging, our aversion, and our delusion, how we think things are, what kind of stories we tell ourselves about the way things are. And when we are caught in aversion or attachment, doesn't it really kind of feel almost like a burning? You know, a kind of, you know, oh, I want that, you know. Oh, I so want to, you know, I'm so attracted to that person, you know. It's this almost unable to let it go, right? It's a kind of, inside, almost a kind of burning or an aversion, like, get me out of here. I don't want this. I really don't want that. So, certainly I think when we cling, or when we feel aversion, we can break out into flames. in different ways. I'm not sure that that's exactly what the Buddha intended here, but I think this language still works in English. That we kind of experience a kind of burning when we are caught up in our attachment and our clinging. The other thing that he is pointing out here, of course, the three poisons. The other element of, he said, you know, everything's a flame. Of course, when we're caught by those three poisons, we really feel it. But he says, everything's a flame. And what does flame do? What does fire do?
It destroys what it's feeding on.
It destroys. It transforms. Mm-hmm. Okay? We can probably say destroy, but in a sense, it transforms. Everything is impermanent. Everything is undergoing transformation. There is nothing that is permanent. In that sense, everything is a flame. Now, often we think of flame as, you know, destroying, and it does. It destroys something that we want to keep, perhaps. But I think what he's pointing out here is that there is nothing that we can hang on to, nothing that we can cling to, nothing that is permanent in our lives. And he says, as I, in the last lines here, he says, "A flame, I tell you, with birth, aging, death, sorrows." So, of course, everything is born. Being born, everything will die. Everything will be changed. And if we can't find equanimity with that, we experience sorrow, we experience despair, distress, pains, lamentations, etc. And he clearly points out, in as he goes through this, as that this burning, this constant impermanence, this transformation, is inherent in everything. It's impersonal. It's not directed at you. It's just the way things are. It's not your fault, but it's just the way things are. See this. See this. This is what he's asking us to look at. See this clearly. This is the truth of the world. This is the truth of our life. And it applies to everything that's unpleasant, and it applies to everything that's pleasant. Everything changes. When I read this, I was reminded of another example that's in the Mahayana tradition. That's the tradition that comes a bit later. And that appears in the Lotus Sutra, the parable of the burning house, which I won't go into in great detail at the moment, but just to say, I'll give you the quick synopsis of it. A traveler or a merchant comes home, and his house, which is old and rickety and this kind of like almost falling down mansion with filled with kind of creepy crawly things, inside there his kids are playing, but it's a flame. It's burning, and he has to find a way to get them out. And he calls to them, but they won't come out just because they're called. He has to lure them out somehow. And how he does that is by saying, "I've got all kinds of wonderful carts out here I brought back with me from my travels. Come and see them." And at that, they immediately drop their video games and they rush out of the house. And it's a very famous story, and it's about skillful means. But also this idea that, you know, we get entranced in our life, and we suffer from this entrancement, and we kind of think, if I only had more, if I could only get better, I'll be happy. It will be okay. And he's saying, this burning house parable is like saying, you know, that's not going to work. But we've got to get you out of the burning house somehow. Okay. So how do we deal with this situation? Everything's a flame. The Buddha, very graciously and compassionately, does not leave us there. He offers us some medicine. So let's go back to the sutta here. And right at the kind of bottom of the page, it goes, seeing thus. Got that? So, could someone read that?
Seeing thus, the instructed noble disciple grows disenchanted with the eye, disenchanted with forms, disenchanted with the consciousness at the eye, disenchanted with the contact at the eye. And whatever there is that arises in dependence on contact at the eye, experienced as pleasure, pain, or neither pleasure nor pain, with that too he grows disenchanted.
Good, thank you. And let's read the next one as well. Someone would...
He grows disenchanted with the ear, disenchanted with sounds, disenchanted with consciousness at the ear, disenchanted with contact at the ear, and whatever there is that arises in dependence on contact at the ear, experiences pleasure, pain, or neither pleasure nor pain, with that too he grows disenchanted.
Yeah. Disenchanted. Let's just pause there, and you can see it will go on for a little bit more, following that same kind of pattern. I really like the way he translated this. We become disenchanted, because it implies that we are enchanted. We are caught up in an enchantment, reaching out, you know, finding happiness, finding satisfaction somewhere out there. Right? If this only had ice in it. Right? It'd be great. So we become... what he's saying here is not, as I think often it can seem, kind of harsh and cold, you know, like we cut ourselves off from all pleasure. I don't think he's saying that, really. But he's saying is we let go of it. And in the Mahayana tradition, this becomes very clear, because... I meant to bring some poems, which unfortunately they're sitting at home on a file on my computer and I forgot to print them out. But there are poems about, you know, letting go, but appreciating this moment as it is, the great beauty of this moment, and letting go. And this, what the Buddha is describing here is this process. We have to let go. We have to step back from this enchantment. But I don't think he's saying, you know, we squash our pleasure or we squash our senses by saying, don't get enchanted by it. Don't get caught and trying to hang on or feel aversion when it's something we don't want, right? When we see the dog shit on the sidewalk, you know, and feel, what's wrong with those people and their dogs? And, you know, and we can get into a kind of burning. At least I can. Don't you? You know. So the Buddha taught that you have a choice, I think, of not adding fuel to the fire by disenchanting, by unenchanting, if there's such an expression, ourselves. And how do we do that? We do that with our practice. And we do that with seeing, as it says in that first line, you know, seeing thus. We look, this is what's happening. This is what's happening. I am adding fuel to the fire. And in this sense, we become weary. We become weary of clinging. We become weary of aversion. And we become, I think, weary of our confusion. And we let go. It's like, enough. Right? I'm tired of getting pissed off at this. I'm tired of, you know, always wanting that. You know, there's a kind of weariness that arises. Does that make sense? You know, and maybe it's stronger, but I've been thinking of this. When we kind of realize, enough already. What am I doing? So let's go back, let's go back to the sutta here, and down to the last two paragraphs, and the second paragraph from the end. Could someone read that for me, please?
Sutta Disenchanted, he becomes dispassionate. Through dispassion, he is fully released. With full release, there is the knowledge. Fully released, he discerns that birth is depleted, the holy life fulfilled, the task done. There is nothing further for this world.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and then the last little line. The last part there, someone? Yeah, Sarah?
That is what the Blessed One said. Gratified, the monks delighted at his words. And while this explanation was being given, the hearts of the 1,000 monks, though through no clinging, not being sustained, were fully released from fermentation effluence.
A little odd. There, yes. But I think you get the picture, right? Released, right? So they awaken. So yeah, I like this translation, except for the last line.
Yeah, it's odd.
It's a little bit strange. But anyway, but we won't go into that part right here because it's just another way of kind of approaching this idea of a release. Dispassion, right? Dispassion. Now, many translations, I can't remember the Pali word, but translate this as a kind of cooling. I think the literal meaning of the Pali word is become cool. We become cool. So dispassion does not, unfortunately, also has a connotation in English of almost like not caring, right? Like, don't care anymore. But that's not really what's meant here. And when we see it translated in other ways, that becomes quite clear. But it's a kind of letting go, a kind of releasing of our aversion, releasing of the clinging. And why do we release? Partly because we become disenchanted. We let go, our enchantment ends. And there's no longer the need to hang on or to try grasp or to try push away. Anybody here awakened yet? Did it work? I never know. I guess the Buddha was such a charismatic and powerful speaker that, you know, he had a tremendous effect on the people around him.
Maybe the monks had done a whole bunch of work. Mm-hmm.
That too, right? These were 1,000 guys who spent probably a long time, you know, doing strong practice.
And having all that hair shaved off.
That would be a shock. Yeah.
Free.
Yeah.
Cleaner.
The practice that we do here in the Zendo, this kind of quiet sitting, this kind of really being fully present with our life, is the way that we let go or overcome the enchantment. It's the way that we begin to enter into a kind of open and spacious place to allow our life to really reach out. In a sense, we become fully alive. And I think part of that is the awakening or the realization that we cannot have a frictionless life. We all want to have a frictionless life, I think, right? We're trying to make life easy, smooth, clean, free of stains, free of boo-boos, let alone of the big things that happen in our life. And that will never happen. There's no app for that, I'm afraid. But what we can do is let go of our aversion and let go of our clinging through our practice. So I think I'll pause there. And I'm going to have us get into small groups. And I'd like us to discuss, how do you catch fire? What lights your fire, baby? How do you catch fire? And what brings you to coolness? What brings you to coolness? And it can be something you know, simple things in life, or it can be something a little stronger. It's up to you. I'll just give you one quick example, and then we'll get into groups. This happened quite a while ago at a retreat I was at, and it was very hot. I was sitting there sweating away, and the woman who was sitting right beside me had severe allergies, and she would, about every 3 minutes, go... And I burned that retreat. Yeah. I did find a kind of coolness at the end, but anyway. So it was 6 days. 6 days. So anyway, I'll end here, and then I'll ask us to get into groups. So anyway, thank you for listening.
Thank you.
And feel free to hang on to the paper if you'd like.